Hey, this is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction show. Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Joel Elston here. It's Thursday, February the 2nd, 2017. We continue this week with our ongoing exploration of Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. We're up to Chapter 8 in this 8th episode of our series. Chapter 8 is entitled Decision, the Mastery of Procrastination, the 7th Step Toward Riches. And it begins with a little interesting factoid. It says, accurate analysis of over 25,000 men and women who had experienced failure disclosed the fact that lack of decision was near the head of the list of the 30 major causes of failure. And this is no mere statement of a theory. It is a fact. Joel, I'm a little surprised he doesn't say that it's at the very top of the list.
I am too, Walt. That would seem to be a little more logical placement in my mind.
I would think so, too. I mean, I guess the fact that he mentions it first kind of hints that it's probably number one. But yeah, I'm a little surprised he didn't say it. But nevertheless, it's certainly easy to see. He goes into a little description next about what it takes. Well, not so much what it takes, but what happens when you aren't decisive, when you don't stick to your decisions, and what happens when you do stick to them. He goes on to an example, for instance, about Henry Ford and how Henry Ford was very, very decisive and quick in making his decisions and so forth, and it served him well, even when he was building what was famously described as the world's ugliest car, the Model T. And yet he ended up making a huge fortune from it before he ended up yielding to the idea that maybe he should change the design and turn it into a Model A.
Right, exactly.
And it served him very well. But I think he's right. He goes on to say the majority of people who fail to accumulate money sufficient for their needs are generally easily influenced by the opinions of others. They permit the newspapers and the gossiping neighbors to do their thinking for them. Opinions are the cheapest commodities on the earth. Everyone has a flock of opinions ready to be wished upon anyone who will accept them. If you are influenced by opinions when you reach decisions, you will not succeed in any undertaking, much less in that of transmuting your own desire into money. And I think that's true. There's one other thing, though, that he doesn't go into in the chapter, and so I want to bring it up. And that is the tendency to be indecisive because you have allowed yourself to become afraid that the outcome you are envisioning or that the method you are envisioning for getting there isn't going to work, so you want to give up before you try it.
Well, that's a preconditioned response, and that you know, if you I in my private practice and working with people of all backgrounds, one of the most common ground that I find in this way of thinking is people have a history of storing their failures.
Yes.
It's mentally failures get stored and marked in our brain in a file that's easily accessible. And every time that we have a failure in our life, and there's a lot of reasons behind this. I've either said it on this show or I've certainly said it in my practice and I posted on Facebook. One of the great gifts I ever figured out how to do is redefine the word failure. Because failure for a long time for me was embarrassment. Failure was shame. Failure was, and today failure is if I don't fail once a day, I'm not trying hard enough mentality. But back in the day that, you know, for me, anything that I failed at, I could easily pull it up in my mental Rolodex. And every time I wanted to try something new or put myself out there, the failure index would come out. The list of why it won't work would automatically print in my head. And this is something that most people have to overcome, that it's a traditional way of thinking. One of my people that I like to follow and I have money invested with his company is Warren Buffett with Berkshire Hathaway. I love what he said. He said, when you're watching the cable news channels that are taught, the business channels, and they're all leaning one way, do the exact opposite of what they're saying.
Yes. That's actually pretty good advice because usually the business channel is what they talk about. I mean,
right.
I'm not in the market, but I listen to someone and I say, you got to be kidding. What are you guys smoking?
Right. Well, and he's so aware, Mr. Buffett is so aware. He's done this for years. He if you bought a share of his company, I believe in the beginning it was $200 a share, is trading at over $200,000 a share today.
Wow.
it's an incredible, just an incredible success story. And he's made multiple people very, very wealthy by sort of letting him manage their money. And his concept is based on his – he goes out there. When the internet came along, for example, everybody said, well, you know, Warren Buffett's style of investing is gone. And admittedly, for a couple of years there, he wasn't matching the returns of the internet, obviously. People that invested during that period of time were very, very happy when the internet came crashing down, at least the stocks did. And you know, since then, he has been up multiple thousand percentages since. And I love that because it's not that he's necessarily a contrarian. He doesn't allow the opinion of others to influence his opinion.
Right.
And that's what Mr. Hill is talking about in the book, of do your own stuff and how many people will talk you out of something. I have a several clients that they have this interesting dynamic. So I'll just throw a generic description of a client, 23-year-old male. You know, he's a 23-year-old male. He's either hasn't completed college or just out of college. He's struggled, and his parents are pushing him hard to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So. But every idea he comes up with, the mom and dad have a reason why it doesn't work.
And yeah, that's not a good policy. That's a policy that needs to change.
Right. And they don't realize they're doing it. It's like, well, you know, I want to do this. Well, now, you know, that won't work or this won't work. And, you know, so the kids automatically program, okay, well, Joel, that won't work. And so I've had to talk to the parents on multiple occasions, say, what do you think will work? Well, we don't know. It's up to him. I go, well, no, it's not, because you're not allowing it to be up to him. And the process, you know, we referred on the show a few weeks ago about the concept of the gentleman who needed to take action to do something. We called it walking to the mall, where you have to get out and do something. A lot of the process of what we're going through, when I ask people to get into things, is I don't know if you're starting something, if that's going to be the thing that works, but in this chapter, it sort of touches on this concept. Getting out there and making movements, and your decisions will be based on those things, but you have to start so you can begin. That says a brilliant quote, by the way.
I'll write that one down quick.
yeah, exactly. But you get the point. And I think, you know, the idea that we get so stuck in the concept of why things won't work based on our really inappropriate or wrong thoughts that things have never worked, so, or when I've tried things it was embarrassing, or you know, all that stuff. A lot of baggage comes along with that.
Oh, tons of baggage. I know in my own case. I mean, you were talking about how there's like this file that, you know, gets stored all the reasons why something's going to fail. And I always find it amazing at how really good my subconscious mind is at finding it at exactly the worst time. I mean, it's really just amazingly good at it. The other thing that I find about it is, yeah, I mean, certainly you can get undermined by what other people say. But I really think most of the undermining comes from ourselves, from our own willingness to undermine, in a sense, because I find that when I'm facing something that I'm trying to be decisive, I'm going to go do it, I'm going to try it, you know, see what happens, and then I'm being defeated, the defeat comes through as a feeling of, if the thing that I try fails, it will be a disaster of monumental proportions.
Right.
Which it right. never is. But that doesn't stop it from coming through to me that way. That's the part that's just amazing to me. I mean, well, I'm not sure where I even got that, to be honest.
But it's instilled from a young age. There's a I don't know why I think Thomas Edison said this, but I don't know who said it. I doubt it's Thomas Edison. Every child is an artist until they're told they're not. Mm. Every kid starts out drawing things and their pictures and all that. And at some point, somebody has to say, hey, you're not good at that. Or, you know, everybody believes that we have an unintentional, you know, a lot of times our family and our friends think they're helping us by, well, I don't want you to be disappointed, so I'm telling you this.
Yeah, that's the worst thing you can say to anybody.
Yes.
That really is.
And I don't know how many moms that I say, well, I don't want him to fail, so I'm telling him that that's probably not a good idea. And so now right off the bat, the kid has no underlying ability to deal with things.
And by the way, I don't want to leave that phrase for a second, because that's a really important phrase. Look at what happens when you flip it upside down and restate it as a positive. Instead of, I'm so afraid you're going to fail, flip it around and say, here's an idea that will help you succeed.
Right. Right.
I mean, it has such a different feeling to it.
Well, the idea that we condition ourselves and our family to respond in a lot of ways. I know I had a lot of struggles and stuff in early in my young adulthood, and I've turned that around. And so by no means am I critical of my mom's response, but several years into my recovery, things were going really well. I had my two boys. I had adopted. I've turned my life around. I was successful in business. And I called my mom usually I speak with her on Sunday. So I called her in the middle of the week I had something funny to tell her. And of course my caller ID came up, and her original, she answered the phone by saying, "What's wrong?"
Oh, good golly.
I was like, well, I appreciate your confidence.
Wow.
You know, and she, because it was an odd time, and again, I'm not totally blaming her, because I have, certainly there were some calls, I'm sure, over the years that conditioned her to think that way.
Yeah.
But reconditioning your brain as to what is failure. Failure means you're trying. No one has ever failed unless they were trying. And that you know, the idea, now I'm not saying nobody's ever failed to do the great effort or what have you. There's a whole concept of the level of trying. But at least it means you're trying. I love people that get out there and when I convince them, and I learned this in the gym many years ago, working out, failure is king. Failure is what you're shooting for. You never grow muscles unless you work till failure, period. And so it's an incredible tool. So I sort of have no problem with that. I don't view the word as a negative on any level. Mm-hmm. I view it as a great. I mean, I had a guy, first time a guy met me in the office, he said, "I failed a bunch." And I go, "Great job." And he said, "What?" And then I said, "At least you were trying a bunch. You didn't keep going, because the problem, you kept accepting defeat." And I said, "That's a whole different topic." But failure itself means you're out there trying. And so the as we go and we work toward what we're seeking, it's so easy to solicit or unintentionally just invite and hear everybody's negative view of why something won't work.
Absolutely.
And that's the scary part. Bill Gates had a nice talk one day on the show, on some TV show interviewed, and somebody said, "Well, you know, you're one of the most," at the time he was the wealthiest man in the world. And he said, "Well, what does that feel like?" And he said that, and he was trying to explain that it didn't really feel different than just anybody else. He said, "You don't worry. At some point, you just don't worry about money, and it doesn't matter how many zeros you had on the end," which is a great point.
Yep.
But then he said, "I don't know how many people, when I was developing Windows, I constantly heard why it won't work. Why
for good reason, the first version didn't work, and the second version didn't work either."
Yeah, and he went on and on. And there's people that will argue that still didn't work right. But anyway, that's you know, he doesn't mind that it doesn't work when you're sitting there with you know what, $90 billion in your bank account.
Yeah.
So the idea for him was he didn't keep listening.
Yes.
To the negative, he believed it and stuck it. But when he was inventing this, and this is. They showed a clip of him, and it was some little science fair convention when he was really starting. Nobody knew who he was, really. And they were asking about computers, and somebody said, "Well, I envision one day there'll be more computers in houses than televisions." And the guy laughed and like, "Okay, well, that will be interesting if that happens." And he said, "I'll even go further and say I envision a day where everybody walks around with a handheld computer." And the guy said, "Well, that will be like Star Trek." And he laughed. He said, "It will be way beyond what Star Trek can do with their little handheld computers." Mm. And so I thought, wow, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Well, And I don't know the stat, but I know, like my foster son, now that I have an 11-year-old in the house and I'm learning, you know, sort of how things are going, even more than my older two boys, there is no – they don't watch TV. Everything takes place. They watch YouTube. They watch – it's an entirely different way. He would do fine without a TV in his room.
Sure.
It's they're watching things differently. They watch it on their phones. They watch it on their tablets. And it's just an incredible change in the way we consume. And Bill Gates was way ahead of that. So when we're bringing it back to, you know, Think and Grow Rich, it's talking about decisions and not allowing the other things in life to distract you from what is your mission? What is the point? And let's make a decision and here's how we are going to do this.
Now, in this chapter, he brings up a point and it hammers on it pretty extensively for a large portion of the chapter that, well, it's not the first time. I mean, last chapter, he spent quite a considerable amount of time detailing 10 different ways that you can fail, which didn't strike me as being particularly a good idea. But I let that one go because I figured, well, I can at least skip over that. But in this case, he's advocating a point that I will say I think is at least controversial. So I want to get your take on it. He basically suggests that by presenting examples of people who had to make decisions that would affect their ability to live because people would try to kill them, therefore these examples should inspire us to be decisive. And I have a little trouble with that one. I'm not so sure that's true. For instance, he starts off with the example of Abraham Lincoln. I'll just read it to you. Lincoln's decision to issue his famous Proclamation of Emancipation, which gave freedom to the colored people of America, was rendered with full understanding that his act would turn thousands of friends and political supporters against him. He knew, too, that the carrying out of that proclamation would mean death to thousands of men on the battlefield. In the end, it cost Lincoln his life, and that required courage. Of course, when he made the decision, he didn't really know for sure that he'd be killed. But then he goes on to spend a large chunk of time talking about the founding of the country. And he focuses in particular on three individuals, three individuals who he believes are the real founders of the country. And those three individuals are Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. And these three basically put their lives on the line directly in the face of the British authorities. In fact, there's a very famous story where Samuel Adams is approached by a representative from Governor Gage in Massachusetts and is basically given an opportunity, shall we say, to back off on his anti-crown leanings.
Right.
And he in not rude terms, but in very provocative terms, basically tells him to go to hell. And does so knowing perfectly well that it could lead to Gage having him hung. And then he goes on to talk about 56 men who met in Philadelphia to write the Declaration of Independence. And they were all signing their names knowing perfectly well that if the war went against them, they'd be hung.
Right.
Now he tells this story as a way of inspiring us to be decisive. Look how decisive they were. They were willing to put their lives on the line. And I'm thinking, wow. Do I really want to look at trying to get a business going based on my life that's going to be on the line?
I've read Think and Grow Rich multiple times in its entirety, and I have to apply what matches with me. And when I get to this part, I don't connect to it. I have. A really hard time, you know, equating me doing what I'm doing with people wanting to kill me. In fact, you know, my business is sort of the opposite. I help people. When we read it and when we go through it, it's like with anything else. Not everything is going to hit home. Not everything's going to resonate. And while he knocks it out of the park in 99% of the book, in my mind, I just think this is sort of a personal tangent he goes on that just doesn't really – I don't know how it made it in the book, to be honest with you.
All right. So you have somewhat of a similar reaction to the one I have because I think it's actually counterproductive. That's why I have trouble with it. Because it's not that I think it's counterproductive. I know it's counterproductive. And way that I know it's counterproductive, because it was counterproductive for me, it actually shied me away.
Well, and see, to me, I stick, you know, and I have this automatic delete button when, you know, you and I have talked about Dr. Bruce Lipman, the epigenetics guy. Well, I love 95% of what he says. And then there's a couple things he gets to, and it's like, oh, my God, that's the opposite of what I believe.
I know exactly what, because I did finally, I don't know if I told you, I read the biology of belief on your recommendation. And, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So, you know, while I love 95% of it, there's part of it that I just stay away from. And so I think that's how we you know, I know people that find great hope in the Bible, and they have to pick and choose, you know, okay, now that might not necessarily be there. So whatever documents we're using, but I like the beginning part of this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really gets into the decision-making process and what matters. I'm having a big hard leap into, okay, now my decision-making, and I'm going to be at risk, and it's going to be brave of me. I don't think that's applicable today. I don't think it was applicable back then. I mean, but at least in his mind, you know, it was maybe he has a really great historical mind and he wanted to somehow throw it in the book here. But
I can at least give a justification for it. I'm not really arguing for it, but if I were going to argue for it, I would say that he was publishing this in the midst of the Great Depression, and in the midst of the Great Depression, I mean, it was well named. You know, one-fifth of the entire population was severely depressed and convinced they couldn't get anywhere and convinced they were completely defeated in life. So I guess on some psychological level, I can conceive of the idea that if you point out to them that the worst that can happen is death and that's not nearly as bad as what they're going through, then it becomes a motivator. I mean, is that too crazy an argument?
No, well, I completely agree. That's what he's after. And in fact, I appreciate you pointing that, because I forget the concept of this being written during Depression times.
Right.
And things were really bad, and people were on the edge of starving. It wasn't like they have the safeguards in place we have today, you know, to make sure you don't go hungry and stuff like that. It just truly was your family could die from lack of food. So I guess that needing to go to the extreme to relate would make sense. But I think keeping the concept with the law of attraction, by even mentioning all of this, it's just like, wow, that's just not what we're seeking from the law of attraction.
Right.
You know, it does. I get it. And it does, to me, this is, there's this and two or three other parts in the book that totally doesn't match. It's like randomly, it's like, okay, did somebody hop in there and just copy and paste this in there? Because I love the first part of this chapter. I really do.
The first part's great.
You know, don't let, I see it in business all the time, people influencing their opinions and all this and stepping away. It's when you ask someone for their opinion and you allow it to dictate what you're thinking or feeling, you are giving that person a lot of power, and also you're giving whatever negative energy a lot of times to that person. If a person has a very negative view and you ask him, well, of course everything's going to fail. He's working in a factory making $25 an hour for the or maybe less than that, and so yes, his opinion is that wouldn't work because I need the safety of the job. You know, but what you're talking about is bigger than going out and working in the way. You know, when you go out and work on your own, or you're an entrepreneur, it's scary. And somebody who doesn't have that in them, it would totally be fearful of that. And so they're going to predict failure.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just understanding where it comes from. But that making that decision, and I'm all about researching it. And researching over and over and over and developing an opinion. I have one of my clients, actually, I'm in a convoluted way. I'm spending on my Tuesdays working with a new group called Virginia Center for Addiction Medicine. They do a really good job. And my one of my great mentors, Dr. Sherman Master, is you know, involved with this program. So I'm not volunteering, but I agreed to work with them on Tuesdays.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it interesting that I had a one of the members of my group there was a she is a professor at a local university, and she is a psychology professor. So she's in my group, and she has her mind made up, and we were talking about, and you know, where I often use the law of attraction, positive psychology. But and her response, well, positive psychology was the in thing a few years ago, but it's not that.
It was a fad, huh?
And I said, well, I said, okay, it was very faddish for the concept of going to school and all that. And I said, but you know, my belief system with any type of therapy, it isn't the modality you use as much as it is the connection you make with a person. And there's a lot of science backing that up. Mm-hmm. So I know some people that use, you know, all the different type of techniques, but at the end of the day, it's the connection that you make with your client that actually can lead them in and out of the dark,
which is very, very insightful, because I think that applies not just to therapy. I think that applies to almost any business model. The connection you make with your client is all of it. I mean, it's more important even than your skill level. It's more important than the service you're offering. It's the connection's everything.
Well, there's a technique of a rapid eye movement technique that has been found to be very effective in dealing with people with trauma. Mm. And the concept behind it is that we process trauma in our sleep during the REM sleep cycle. And there's a lot of science behind that. So some therapists decided, okay, well, in the REM sleep, you have this rapid eye movement back and forth. What if we emulated the rapid eye movement while we're processing this trauma while we're awake? Well, she's reported incredible results in working with trauma patients.
No kidding.
Yes.
That's really interesting.
Yes. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is.
Well, then I hear – one of a professor that I respect greatly, he's a doctor who just really studies all the techniques. And I asked him about this, and he said, yes, it works wonderfully. And I'm like, oh, great. And then he's followed with, comma.
Comma.
We use the word comma. He said, everything works. He said, really, Joel, somebody's eyes moving back and forth, really? He said, what's happening is she believes so much in her process, and she connects so deeply with her client, it works. He went on further, and anybody receiving rapid eye movement, please don't stop and don't think I'm saying it, because it does work. It works because you believe it works. And there isn't a magical tool out there that, you know, Dr. Wayne Dreyer used to always talk about tapping. I don't know if you've read any of his tapping techniques.
Yeah.
Well, to be honest with you, the tapping's not doing anything. It's a belief that the tapping is doing something.
Yes, yes.
And that's where it goes. The book, the You Are the Placebo.
Yes.
And by Dr. Joe DiPenza, it really is that concept. His concept is, when you believe in the treatment is successful. And so the rapid eye movement for trauma shows it works great. Well, it does it or does it, or just the fact that you've connected with a client. And so wherever that in life, as you said, in any business, when you connect, sales are an emotional event. If you're a salesperson, there's an emotion attached. And if you could figure out that person's emotional button.
That's it. That's the essence of copywriting. Copywriting is writing for the purpose of selling, and that's exactly what copywriting is about. It's trying to make that emotional connection in a way that's meaningful to the person you're trying to sell to.
Right. One of the things that I'm fascinated by is I have a couple of friends that make an incredible amount of money every year selling very expensive vacuums. I think it's Electrolux. I'm not sure, but they're very expensive vacuum cleaners, and they're good. But I can't imagine that they're, you know, like $2,500 good.
Yeah.
And so how this works, and I'm baffled on how they do this. And, you know, they a large part of theirs, and these are lifetime warranties on these vacuums. And I'm not, you know, putting down these vacuums. They're really good, but in my opinion, they're not that good. So
in your opinion, there isn't a vacuum out there that's good.
No, I buy new carpet. When I can buy new carpet for the cost of the vacuum, I'll just buy the new carpet. But again, that's my opinion. But what they do is they go into homes and when they walk in, they make an assessment of what this person's currency is. What is their emotional drive? Mm-hmm. You walk in and there's evidence of a small child. What they'll do is he'll dump a half a bucket of sand on the ground, put a piece of carpet over it, and suck the sand through the carpet.
That's quite a demonstration.
And then say, and your baby's on this floor. Mm. And then what he does, he'll take their vacuum and vacuum the floor thoroughly, put a new bag in his vacuum, and fill the bag up with dirt the other vacuum missed. Well, a mom who has a couple of babies, a young mom, there's nothing more important to her than the sanitary function of her home.
Right.
Period. It's sold. He's already sold it.
Exactly.
It's sold. Once the mom sees that and dumps it out, and he said that's you know, or if he has a way of quite a process, but like in homes with central heat and air, mm-hmm. he has the ability to like put this up, clog up some of the vents, and then he can use this vacuum to literally suck out the dust in the vents. Again, he can do it in dryer vents and say, this is the you don't need, look how much this will save you. Well, whether it saves them or doesn't save them, it's not relevant. It's finding the emotion that makes the sell happen.
Absolutely.
And so when you tap into that and you don't oversell, and like, you know, he's walked in, showed that demonstration, and you know, he's very trained in body language and ready to go. And when the mom's ready to go, he's had a sell in 9 minutes before.
I don't know if you know this, I'm pretty sure that is Electrolux. And Electrolux has been around since the Great Depression. And that's how long that technique has been around, too. The technique of dumping the dirt on the floor and vacuuming it up through, you know, various, either through the carpet or, you know, various stuff like that. That's been around since they pretty much started selling what some people derisively call suck brooms.
Right.
There's one story that comes from the Great Depression of a young man who decided to sell for one of these companies. I think it was Electrolux. And he goes to his first house, and when the woman opens the door, he steps in, he takes a bucket of dirt and flings it onto the floor and says, I want to show you just how wonderful this vacuum cleaner is. Where can I plug this in? She says, we haven't had electricity laid yet.
Nice. 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 Yeah.
So you do want to know what it is that you're selling and who you're selling to.
Well, that's always a great point. So when you step into the world of understanding, you know, what works and what doesn't work and how all this stuff that goes together mentally, the opinion of others, you know, like he, I don't tell this guy this because I think it's ridiculous for anybody to spend that much money for a vacuum cleaner. I just do. I'm not, I like the
idea of a new carpet if I'm going to spend that money. Right. It makes sense to me.
And so like when he tried on me, he says, well, you know, your kids, if your kids are on the floor, I said, it's good for their immune system. I said, you're making the home too sanitary. They need some germs. So, you know, it's like the concept of, and I have another friend that makes a lot of money selling water purification systems. And again, it's basing it on finding the emotional response that works and then going there. It isn't about logic or it isn't about money or it's about the emotional response.
It's exactly what it is. There was one summer where I sold, have you ever heard of Cutco knives?
Yes.
Yes. I sold Cutco knives for a summer. Actually, I sold it for 3 weeks. I sold a set to my parents. I sold a couple knives to neighbors, and I quit. But for reasons we don't have to go into. Well, actually, maybe it does tie into this. excuse me. But they had one demonstration. They had a number of demonstrations that we would do in order to show just how wonderful these knives were. For instance, we take a half inch thick rope and through one slice through it. But the most impressive one we did is, and it took a little hand strength to do this. We take out a penny. And we take these special scissors that you could sell, and we would slice through the penny.
Right.
And that impresses almost everybody when you show it to them. Because, well, first of all, it does take hand strength to do it. And second of all, you get a really nice clean cut. It's amazing what you can get with these shears. They're just really impressive shears. When you're done with the demonstration and you show them the kind through with a penny, the people who really had no interest in buying anything, all of a sudden they're trying to find something small they can buy. They don't want to, you know, pay a few hundred dollars for the whole knife set, but maybe they can buy one knife.
right. Yeah, it that idea of tapping into your internal stuff is so it's so relevant to what we're talking about today of that file that I mentioned earlier that we store all our failures in. Mm-hmm. And it is the biggest roadblock to people's success. That's our part of our brain.
It's just this
really well rehearsed script of why things won't work, and it's been reinforced by life. It's been reinforced by I've seen that multiple times, and I demonstrated this to a guy that owned a gym in Sarasota, Florida, one time, and he is very competitive market. Owning gyms is very difficult, and it's even harder in today's market because the monthly rates are so competitive. Mm-hmm. But back then, this guy had a really nice gym, and he was automatically apologizing for his high price the moment they walked in the door.
Oh yeah, that's definitely not going to work.
He said, "I know I'm higher than everybody else, but here's the reasons why." Mm. And right off the bat, the people are like, "Oh, wow, he's already higher than everybody else."
I
when I was working with him, I tried to explain. I said, "Here's why your gym's better." Say, "Look, here's we have a pool, we have this, we have that, we have this. Here's all the things we have. If somebody says is it more expensive than the gym down the road? Well, technically yes. However, if you were to go join a pool, if you were to go join a swim club, we have that here. It's built into your membership. If you're going to have classes, you'd pay for them. We have that. So in reality, this is the most cost efficient gym in town. And it, again, selling on that perspective of instead of complaining or suggesting that we're overpriced immediately, that there's great value in there. And then when you tie into, while you're working out, your teenage sons can go out by the pool and swim. No, there's a lifeguard. They'll be safe. You're working out. Right off the bat, that's value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, value is it. Value is what makes different prices. If it weren't for value, there would be no such thing as different prices. Everything would price the same.
Right. And that's such an exciting thing to see that so when we're talking in a bigger picture about decisions and what has happened in your life in the past is almost always a negative shutdown of what keeps us from going. When we learn to move past that, the reasons we're going to be successful, not listening to every person tell you why something isn't going to work. I never tell anyone, I'll have people's opinion, what do you think about this idea? I never say, oh my God, that's a horrible idea, it won't work. I never say that. I might, say, here's some critical thinking points to go along with it. Ask yourself these questions. Look at it and do your research. Is there anybody, for example, if somebody said, "Hey, Joel, I'm going to create a new search engine." Okay, I'm excited for you. Let's do it. But who's your competition? And what are they doing? And what are you going to do that's different from theirs? I'm saying don't do it.
What's the differentiator? That's the question.
Right. Yeah. Are you going to out-Google Google? Now, then go do it. But are you going to out-Google Google? Be prepared, to out-Google Google.
I've actually had people ask me in my capacity over the years as a web designer, could you build me – this is not the way they said it, but it's what they meant. Could you build me eBay? And my answer is always yes, absolutely. I just need a budget of about 7 figures.
Right.
And they can't understand that. How could that possibly be? I mean, because it's just a bunch of web pages, right?
what they don't get, eBay started as a couple of web pages. But as they've added and built over the years and all the security, all the stuff they've had to, they have done reactionary development by having to sort of meet the challenges as they go. To go in and go in at eBay's level, it, like you say, seven figures would be, you know, that's pretty good price, really.
Actually,
you
know? It is, yeah. I mean, because they spend that many in a month.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's what people just don't understand is what, you know, what are we going to be doing? How are we going to compete, and what differentiates us, and why are we doing it? That isn't negative thinking. It's critical thinking that I need to do my research, make my decisions, hear opinions. But at the end of the day, I can't be influenced by the negativity of others, because the average person is built in negative. It is, you know, we all are conditioned to fail in a negative way. Failure is a negative word. Anytime, again, it freaks people out when I talk about my definition. I've had a couple of people actually get real frustrated with me about failure, the term failure on the internet, when I'm doing some Facebook posts. They get very...
Well, let's be honest. Your approach to failure is not anywhere near the norm.
No. And it you know, I'll hear people, you know, they just... Well, you don't understand what it's like to go through. I'm like, yes, I don't understand what it's like to, you know. Yes.
We've heard that one a few times, haven't we?
But it's to me, it's about reassigning value to what matters. Success, my formula for success includes a whole lot of failure. That's the only way I've ever been successful. Failure didn't stop me. It just encouraged me to go stronger and harder.
Right. Yes. And the other thing that I think is really interesting here is you mentioned a number of times the concept of how our brains have these files of all the reasons why things are going to fail and all the reasons why it's not going to work, and that we're really good. I totally agree. We're really good at accessing that file, better almost than any other file in our brain.
I completely agree with that.
I mean, it's like our subconscious mind is saying, okay, I'm just waiting for you to bring this up so I can hammer it home. But it strikes me that the number one application, I guess is the word, that I can think of that this whole thing fits for is the law of attraction. I mean, is there another concept out there that so many people instantly have so much resistance to the first time they hear it, because their brains are saying to them, that's not the way the world works?
Yes, that's exactly what I believe he's talking about here. When I read this, the opposite of the norm is what we're seeking, and the world works in a way that, you know, currently we record this show a few days before it actually airs. So, assuming that our president hasn't been impeached at this point, the air shows. We're seeing an entirely different way of him doing things, and what is causing a lot of stress to a lot of people is, let's step away from the fact whether we agree or disagree with him. He's just doing it differently, and
very differently.
And it's creating a please hear, I'm not doing a political commentary. I'm just saying the response is from people that he's doing it differently. He's doing it in a way that's never been done before, and how that's going to work is still left to interpretation. But
our brains are still saying that's not going to work. That's not going to work. Right. That's not going to work.
So what I'm trying to let everybody know, and I think you and I were discussing this maybe before the show, is what if we just took a deep breath and said, I will be open to the, while I don't have to agree with him, at least I'll be open to the different attempt. You know, and you know, he wrote in his book, the president wrote in his book, The Art of a Deal. And maybe this is what he's doing. He talks about when he does a deal, he'll go in with just a crazy number, either up or down. Like, you know, I want to sell you a building for $2 billion. And then people are like, are you kidding? It's worth $100 million and not $2 billion. And then he'll tell them why it's worth $2 billion and literally walk away from the building and then come back and say, okay, never mind. I'll take 500.
Yeah, right.
And he does a lot of those deals, or he does it the other way. So maybe that's what he's doing now. But instead of us trying to just see if it's going to happen, there's a lot of reaction to, oh my God, this is, you know, this is, it's just how, it's how we are perceiving things, thinking and growing internally, thinking and growing externally is allowing the concepts not to always be the same. That redundant thinking pattern, that file that keeps telling you this result is going to be the same as this negative experience when you remember when you tried this and you were embarrassed horribly. You remember when this happened and you were embarrassed and you failed and you lost and that's such a negative thing, you know, versus I remember the day in the gym that there's certain benchmarks that you get to when you're in weightlifting. And for a weightlifter, especially the number 315 pounds, it's the way the bars are set up. That's an important number. And then the next big number is 405 pounds. Very few people ever do that. I spent 6 months trying every other day to bench press 405 pounds. And when I did it, I wasn't looking at all the failures I did. I saw them as a necessary event to get me to the success of bench pressing 405 pounds.
And what you mean is this was the mindset you were adopting before you successfully did it.
Yes. And that's so I looked at it as a step forward every time that I failed. And that's the hard, that's where people start getting, wow, Joel, that sounds so, but listening to other people's opinions and talking yourself out of your dreams, if you really have done your research and you're really going to go do this, you can't, the whole concept of the law of attraction is you cannot halfway go into this. It has to be in there is no doubt in my, there was never a moment that entire time that I did not believe that I eventually would bench press 405 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
There was never a moment. I whether I would do it that day or not was a question, but I would never doubt that it was going to happen. And being successful is the same thing. Never doubt it, but it the biggest battle is what we talk about in this first part of chapter 8. It really is. That's where the law of attraction hits the critical process of the mind and that file of failure. That's where that's where they merge, and that's where defeat happens in a negative way for most people.
Interestingly enough, too, this is almost where it shows just why we know that parents in particular or friends or whatever are reacting negatively subconsciously. They're not doing it deliberately, because if they were aware of this, they would certainly change it in many cases. But one of the best things that we can actually do is to help someone else to solve, you know, the problem of overcoming indecisiveness, to, you know, go for it, to just go for that impossible dream, to run that 4-minute mile, even though no one's run it before Roger Bannister does. And the reason I say that is, I mean, you run into this all the time. You experience this every single day through your therapy practice, because you are constantly helping people to go after something that's beyond their comfort zone. That's, I'm sure, part of what your whole approach is. And it's a lot easier to do with somebody else, because unlike that somebody else, you don't have the direct emotional involvement that they have. When you're trying to do it for yourself, it's a more of a challenge. So you can still do it. It's just more of a challenge. And that challenge exists because of all the emotional baggage, which we referred to earlier, that comes along with it. So it's so much easier to help somebody else. And that is a really important lesson, because instead of getting doubtful about, you know, what somebody else suggests, instead of pointing out all the reasons why it can't work, what if we were to do what's the easier thing to do, which is to be supportive and say, well, I honestly don't know how that can work, but it's interesting, you know, what's going to be your next step, you know, and turn into a positive support thing slowly. Because when you do that, and then you get to the point where you say, well, shoot, the worst thing that happens is it doesn't work. Let's go for it. Go for it. See what happens. You know, if it doesn't work, okay, you just go on to the next try. You do it a different way the next time. If we had a whole bunch of people doing that, we'd have an entirely different society.
Well, that's the beauty of what the law of attraction offers, is an entirely different society if we could just implement that. I had a gentleman call me very rare. You know, I keep my cell phone on all night, but I have the ringer off when I go to bed. I seldom get calls in the middle of the night. Well, about I'm up at 5:30. Well, the other morning about 5:35, the phone was ringing. I didn't recognize the number, and I almost let it go to voicemail. And I said, let's just see what the universe is bringing us today.
Yeah, right.
And so I answered it, and there's a very nice gentleman. And he described a situation, a 62-year-old male. He's been in recovery from alcohol for 9 months. And he said, I'm about to fall apart. I'm about to lose my job. I haven't drank yet, but I'm going to probably drink. Is there any way I can see you today? I didn't have really any time, but I added some time at the beginning of the day. And I said, well, I can get to my office maybe by 8. My first appointment was at 9. So it might be a few minutes late. And so I met him. And he began describing, I said, please tell me what's happening. And he, a very nice gentleman, sincere about trying to get better. But he had his employee evaluation at the beginning of the week. And he got a very good evaluation, except at the end, his worker, his evaluation provider, I guess it would be a supervisor, said, you're doing a good job, except you've lost your confidence. And we need you to get your confidence back.
Ooh.
So he interpreted that as I'm about to lose my job. So he's replaying that one statement she made over and over and over in his mind, and was, you've heard me use the term awfulizing.
Yep.
He was awfulizing the totally ignoring the fact she had given him a good performance review, that he's been there at the company for 20 years. He has a lot of great stuff going. So we processed a little bit, and he said, he couldn't hear it for a while. And I said, no, what you're doing is you're taking what she was attempting to be a constructive comment, and you're awfulizing the comment. You're putting yourself in a position of this is not helpful. This is I'm about to lose my job. I've lost my confidence. I can't do anything. And he said, the projects that they're giving me are overwhelming. And I said, well, okay, how many projects have you not been able to complete? And he thought for me, he goes, none. I said, but yet they're overwhelming. I said, which is the truth?
Yeah, and there's a disparity going on there, isn't there?
Right. Yeah, and so by the end of the exciting thing, and this was just one session, I literally had about 45 minutes with him, so I was trying to speed the process up, and I'll follow up with him. But this was such an amazing, just to see in a 45-minute session his body language change. And I said, what's she saying? You lost your confidence. She's asking you not to leave. She's asking you to get your confidence back. She wants that person back. And he left with a really good mindset of like, you're right. I see that now. And so he went to work. He texted me. I gave him a copy of The Secret. And he said, well, I don't like to read. And I said, well, I'm going to give you a copy. You can read it or you can throw it in the garbage. I don't care. Do whatever you want to do with it. And just consider reading it because it's a lot of good information. So on his lunch hour, he started reading it and he said, I got surprisingly far and it's making a lot of sense. And he began the process of looking at things differently all in a day.
That's really now, a big day. That's a huge day.
Yeah, now I'm not saying we're not over the hump. We don't have a lot more to do. Of course we do, but the fact that this is an internal choice of, you know, my Facebook post today is I've Joel Elston on Facebook I have my life coaching business and my personal stuff is open to the public. Today I did an in-depth step-by-step guide to being happy today on my Facebook post, if you want to do it, but I'll read it to you. It won't take long.
Okay.
It's a step-by-step guide to happiness, guaranteed to work. Step one, be happy.
I love it. You
successfully completed your training.
That's right.
it truly, we overthink it. It's a choice. Happiness is a choice that you and you alone can make. And from the place of happiness, from the place of joy, is when you're most in tune with what you're attracting in the law of attraction. So if you choose to be happy, you get so much what you want. If you choose to be sad or buy into the sad concept that everything's falling apart, that's when everything starts falling apart. That nothing changed in this gentleman's mind in that 45-minute session except his perspective that he was completely in charge of. He just needed somebody to help him see it.
And by the way, I don't want to miss and overlook what the supervisor said, because the supervisor missed a golden opportunity. She missed the opportunity to show him how to get his confidence back.
Right.
She said she laid a burden on him. The burden was, we need you to be more confident. But if she had, I don't know what his history is, that's why I'm pausing. I'm not sure what to draw on. But through his history, she knew something about his history at the company there. So all she had to do was redirect him to, remember how you were feeling when you were doing X and you produced a wonderful result from X. That's what the feeling we want you to have, because when you feel that way, you are a much more productive person. And we love that. That would have been a completely different evaluation instead of, well, we need you to get your confidence back.
Right. Right. And that's such an incredible, those opportunities in life, they lie every day. They're there for us. They're available to us every day to use these things to help others. And now, if that supervisor would have had that next step, she could have really helped develop her employee.
Oh, amazingly. I mean, that she would have turned what turned out to be a negative interview from the perspective of the employee into a super positive, powerful, amazing launch of a new employee interview.
Right. And that's such an important piece. And I challenge our audience. What an incredible opportunity that exists in us all. And in chapter 8, again, the first part of chapter 8, it's talking about the defeat of procrastination and allowing the opinion of others and all the other stuff, the years of training that we develop this way of thinking by spending all of our energy on the file of the negative. Well, I draw on a file of positive now. I look at the times that things have worked out. I am 100% successful of getting through things I never thought I would get through. I have 100% success rate. I'm pretty confident that going forward, now I'm not saying that everything's going to work perfectly, but I always get through it. I always overcome it. I always end up in a better place.
And how do we know that? Because you're still here.
I'm still here. And everybody listening is 100% successful. Doesn't mean we don't have failures or downtime, but we survived it. A lot of the stuff I've been through, I never thought I would survive. I did. Here I am. Proof of that.
And boy, that's such an important message for all of us, because it's so easy to be defeated by that file cabinet in the brain. But we're still here.
Yeah.
And that's the defeat. That's the way you defeat it. We're still here. Yeah, okay, subconscious mind, you can bring out that file all you want to, but guess what? I'm still here. Yeah, yeah.
And that becomes the thing. And when that file becomes a positive, when you can learn to access that positive thing of all the times you did overcome, and no matter how bad things are, you're going to get to the other side of it, that becomes exciting.
That becomes very exciting, and it becomes empowering. And that's really what this is all about. Decision and decisiveness is about empowering yourself.
Absolutely. Very important. And so this is a great chapter, at least the first part.
We'll skip the second part. No matter how extensive it is, it's great if you want to read about American history, but I don't really recommend it for, getting yourself off the schneid, no.
Exactly. And with anything we say, this is a bag of tools. This is and not every single thing works for every single person. We hope you can get inspired by what we're talking about. I hope that this empowers you to think differently and move forward. But it all might not apply to you. Quit spending the energy of what doesn't apply and focus on what does.
Absolutely. And as we draw to a close, I want to remind everybody, as I've been trying to do and Joel has tried to do a number of times here on the show, make sure you subscribe to our podcast. You can find us at loatoday.net. We're on iTunes. We're in the iTunes store, Yahoo. We are on YouTube. You can find us on Facebook. Any way that you can find us to subscribe to us. And, of course, here on PRN. Obviously, keep listening on PRN. But subscribe to us so that you can follow this ongoing saga of our exploration of Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And once again, Joel, we've come to an end of an hour. But as usual, we keep ending up on a high. I love it.
That's great, Walt. Always good to talk to you, my friend.
Good talking to you, too. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.